Candlelight by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 8. The old man was sitting before the eternal pile of letters. Suddenly he picked one up, and there was the rustle of paper, and then he started to chuckle. "Hey," he called out, "listen to this. This is in a letter which I've just opened." He read out from the letter. There was one of these charter flights going from Los Angeles to London, England. A group of people were going to have a tour of the historic places of London and of England. The plane arrived in England and the tour began. All the people got into one of the chartered buses and drove off to a place called Runnymede, one of the historic places of the world, not just of England, a place where liberty started centuries ago. The guide stood up before the crowd of American tourists with their Bermuda shorts and their cameras and their owlish eyes behind their great glasses, and he said, "And here, ladies and gentlemen, is a truly historic spot. This is an important place. 1215, Magna Carta was signed here." One fat floozy looked at her watch and snorted with annoyance. "Too bad. We missed it by 20 minutes. But it is such a short step from mirth to melancholy. Here is a person who is most concerned about death. You write a lot about death and about the joys in it for those who escape from the difficulties of the earth, but you never say anything of help to us who are left here. How about telling us something in the book you're writing about grief and what we can do? It's all right for those who have passed over, but it's not so all right for those of us who are left. So how about saying a bit about grief?" "Very well, that's fair enough. Death and grief are so grossly misunderstood, misrepresented. Just about everyone in existence has had grief, the loss of a loved child, the loss of a loved parent or partner or pet. Grief is a terrible thing indeed, and if one sits hard on one's emotions, it can do definite damage. People should understand that the system approved by present-day society is not always the best. The old Chinese, for instance, used to laugh heartily as they told of the death of a loved one. The old Chinese simply could not face the thought of showing their emotions, showing the emotion of grief to the world, and so they put on a wholly artificial levity about the matter. There's no way of terminating the pain which a loss causes us. No way of ending the grief. Only time can do that. Time heals all. Time will terminate the pain of grief. Time will terminate the troubles of this turbulent earth. Time will end life itself. One of the biggest curses of modern day life is the attitude of the undertakers and funeral home people, because they, no doubt for reasons of business, try to pretend the loved one... try to pretend that one's loved one is not dead, but merely sleeps. These undertakers paint the dead faces. They wave the dead hair. They prop up the dead body as if simulating a person who is drowsing on a cushion of satin. It seems to be a universal conspiracy in present-day life to conceal grief as if there's something shockingly shameful in showing emotion at a loss. A person who goes on a long journey to the other side of the world, for instance, well, there's always the possibility of the person coming back. But when a person is dead, then that person has gone from this earth, and it's highly improbable that they will come back. Often, grief is tinged with definite hostility, hostility that a person has died and left one behind. Now, just think about that. And irrational though it seems, it is true. There is some sort of subconscious hostility towards a dead person. And often, too, there's a feeling of guilt. Could we have done more for the suffering person? Could we have in any way saved the life? Could we have eased the suffering? Well, if a person puts us in the wrong, we often resent that person. So when a death occurs, there is much soul searching. Who is to blame? What more could have been done? Or how could he have done this thing to me? How could he have gone out of my life? Undertakers go to fantastic lengths to pretend that the corpse is just a sleeping body. They falsify values, and in my opinion, it's very wrong indeed to shove a body in some unnatural attitude, unnatural for death, that is, and pretend that he or she is just sleeping. We should have a new concept of death. Nations should spend money investigating death and teaching people that grief is natural. Grief is normal. Grief is a safety valve, enabling one's bottled emotions to be harmlessly drained away. Great men like Winston Churchill were not afraid to shed tears when the occasion warranted it. Winston Churchill, it is said, could shed tears of emotion and tears of grief, and he was a better man for it. Now, you ask, what could be done to help a person suffering grief through the loss of a partner or relative? Let us not have any of this hypocrisy about a loved one, because often, young people find a great relief in the loss or death of an old, tiresome parent. They feel ashamed of their relief, and so they rant on about the loved one. The first thing to do is to face that death has occurred, to face that things are now different. There will be red tape. There will be interfering officials. They'll want all sorts of papers signed. Heartless officials of the country will want their own share of whatever legacy is left. One can help a lot by listening to the person who has been bereaved. Listen and let the grieving person talk. Let the person talk out his or her sorrows. Let him or her discuss the past. In this way, guilt will be drained off, grief will be drained off, and the one who has died will be freer. It is quite essential that a person be helped to get over grief. It doesn't do to let a person stay alone grieving, mourning with a hard, straight face, showing nothing to the outside world, because the grief bottled up inside one appears somewhere. It's like a steam boiler. You can't screw down the safety valve and keep putting on the heat. Something will burst eventually. A person who is overcome with grief, which is kept bottled up, will later suffer from ulcers or severe bowel trouble, or can even start arthritis. In extreme cases, and I have two such neighbors not too far away from me, schizophrenia can occur. A young woman, for instance, who appears to have everything, who appears to be fairly balanced, can suddenly be struck down by the death of her relative. She becomes mentally deranged. She wanders about, brooding, sullen, and dirty. These things happen, but they would not happen if there was more understanding of the nature of grief. It would not happen if neighbors would help by letting the person talk, by keeping silent themselves, except for sympathetic noises at the appropriate times. How many times do you hear a bereaved person say, "If only I had acted differently, he'd be with us today"? There are other cases where a bereaved person will rant at the dead person, ranting on about, "Why did he have to die and leave me? What am I going to do now?" One of the worst features of the funeral service is the eulogy, where someone speaks a whole lot of hogwash about the bereaved. No one who has ever died is bad, it seems. People search around for someone who can tell a whole lot of lies, saying how good the dead person was and what a dreadful loss it'll be to the community. But that's bad, you know. It makes a bereaved person think that he or she has lost something far, far greater than is really the case. There are often cases where a husband loses his wife, perhaps in childbirth. The man, now a father, has undisguised hostility for the poor, innocent baby who, in being born, quite inadvertently caused the death of the mother. So there is a father ruined, and a baby ruined, right at the start. If people would only clear up their conceptions about things. Now, grief, what is it? Often it is selfishness. It is often opposition to any change. People do not like a change, which is permanent, so when death occurs, well, that is permanent. That's a considerable change, and resentment and hostility occur. What you should do is this. Help a person who is bereaved by encouraging that person to talk. And if the person weeps, so much the better. In weeping, the emotions are released, and then there is no risk of one's sanity. You can talk gently but firmly to the person, telling them to weep, telling them not to bottle up their emotions, telling them that, yes, they have had a terrible loss, but soon they too will be moving on to the other side of the curtain, which divides the dead of this world from the living of the next world. And if you are a good psychologist, the best psychologists come from the homes and not from the offices of so-called professional men. You can do a lot to help those who need your help. I do want to mention here that, whereas people should be encouraged to give vent to grief in order to get it out of their system, they should not be encouraged to persist in grief, because such is merely grieving for their own loss, and not genuine grief, Now it is self-pity, and such is not to be encouraged. While on this subject, here's another letter which surely does apply to the present. A most shocking thing occurred when my father was dying. My young daughter, just 18 years of age, lay down on a couch, and do you know, she fell sound asleep. When my father was dying, I can never forgive her for that. But you know, we must remember that there are certain people who are helpers of those passing over. These persons, it doesn't matter what age they are, it doesn't matter what class they are, but these persons have an ability to help a person over into the next life in much the same way as a midwife has the ability to help a baby to become born and separated from its mother. The midwife has to stay wide awake, but the helper has to appear to go to sleep because the astral form has to emerge from the body. Hence, in this case, the young daughter did not thoughtlessly fall asleep. Instead, she had the ability to leave her body and help her grandfather to enter his new life. There are so many things that could be said on the matter of death. For example, in the days of Atlantis and Lemuria, there were always bodies kept in cool chambers. Dead bodies, or apparently dead bodies. These were entity-less bodies, which were kept so that the gardeners of the earth could, at any time, take over a body and appear among humans as a human. These were the first examples of time travel, because the gardeners of the earth, who know all and can do all, have to travel to different worlds and mix with different entities, and so, as stated, they do keep certain bodies which can be entered by arrangement. This is not necessarily the same as transmigration, because in the latter, an entity takes over a body by special arrangement and special permission, of course, and remains in that body for the rest of its life on earth. But the gardeners of the earth could take over a body, go anywhere for a time, and then leave the body, just the same as a person can rent a car, take a journey, and then return the car to the renters. Possibly we ought to start up a travel service on those lines. Now, let us say a few words about getting old. It is a thoroughly obnoxious practice which affects all of us, no matter how much we try to disguise that unpleasant fact, no matter how much powder and paint we put on, no matter how much we try to tell ourselves otherwise. There comes a time when in the morning you find your joints are creaking a bit, you don't get up as easily as you did. So you then reach the inescapable conclusion that you are getting old. When people are getting old, or rather, when they have become old, they do seem to go to pieces rather quickly, but that's natural, isn't it? Whatever you say about it, people are just flowers of the over-self. Flowers are merely devices to draw attention to the seeds, and people, then, are just the flowers which have the seeds to reproduce other members of a species or a race. A woman is supposed to be attractive to the male, so that in the union which follows, certain acts occur which enable the race to be propagated and so to continue. After all, Men and women are here for a purpose, to continue the race, so that all the time people are learning and learning. But according to the basic law of nature, when reproduction is no longer possible because of deterioration caused by age, then there is no longer any real need for the life to continue. When people have gone beyond the age at which they can contribute towards producing other humans, then on the purely material plane, they have finished. In the old days, when the race of man was young, people lived to be 30 or 40 years of age, and then, when they could no longer sire or bear children, they died off. It was much the same as flowers. You get a plant. Eventually, on the plant, flowers bloom and seeds are within the flower. After a time, the flower withers and falls off, and so that is the end of that flower. It has done its task in having the seeds, making the seeds available. When that task is ended, the reason for the existence of the flower has also ended. Humans used to be more like that. But science, so-called, has prolonged the lifespan, perhaps two or three times as much as was normal in the early days of the race. But people still chase around, trying to give an illusion of youth, because they have a racial memory that without the ability to reproduce, they are no longer of use. And so they seek a false youth, in which they're trying to persuade others that, yes, I can still sire or bear children, and that, they claim, is an excuse or a reason for going on living. We see this particularly in the life story of Hollywood idols. A fellow claims that he's the biggest sirer of children in existence. Or some crummy-looking film actress, which probably surgically increased her bust, uplift, claims that she's the best sex symbol ever. Phooey! It's the mind and the soul that matter, not the lumps of meat which clothe the bony framework. In the oldest races, people used to die young, except for a very few old people who were deliberately left there by the gardeners of the earth to teach and to pass on knowledge of a far more than normal lifetime. But this present-day craze with women getting themselves done up like something they never were, well, that's just a matter of self-justification, which means that they still want to compete on the field, or should it be the bed, of sex. If people would only be themselves and act their age, they'd be far happier. There would be less nervous troubles. There would be less hostility from other age groups. But sad though it seems, it may even be that the gardeners of the earth are to blame for the horrible state to which mankind has descended. When a garden, no matter how wonderful that garden be, is neglected for too long through the absence of its gardener, then the garden degenerates. Everything goes to pot. Humans sure have gone there fast. Humans are in a great state of confusion about their origin. They don't know why they should consider material things and metaphysical things. They don't know where things fit in. They see a human body, but they don't see the soul. So they are more inclined to place credence on the purely physical human body. And yet, humans pray to, or revere, a trinity, which through long years of Christian usage is known as Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Actually, the Trinity is the Over-Self, which is the Holy Ghost, the astral form, which is the intermediary, and then the third, which is the purely physical body on the earth. The physical body on the earth is the laborer, the one who does hard things to learn hard lessons, which the more intangible Over-Self could not endure. You can say, in a similar way, that an uncouth savage could endure more torture than a highly refined gentlewoman. So the physical torture would be on the lowest plane, but the highly refined gentlewoman would be able to withstand far more mental shocks than would the savage. Humans should remember that they are basically three entities: the physical, which is the earth body, the astral, and the Over-Self. Actually, there are nine different sheaths, from the physical to the astral, but that does not matter for now, because they are in different dimensions, and when one is trying to discuss things in a three-dimensional category, it is not easily possible to discuss things of a nine-dimensional existence. And to confuse you thoroughly, on other planes of existence, there are more than the nine sheaths. You can add a few noughts or zeros if you've ever been there. I have. A Christian person who is very anxious that his name will not be mentioned writes to me. In fact, he's so anxious that his name will not be mentioned that he doesn't give any. Unfortunately for him, he used a piece of his own headed paper and in a moment of forgetfulness wrote on the obverse, or if you like it simple, he wrote on the side which had no address. The other side carried his name and address. But never mind, I won't give his name or his address, but I will tell you this. Many people of religious persuasion write to me. Bishops write to me, a cardinal has been in correspondence with me, and incidentally, thoroughly approving of my work. A pity I can't get him to give a statement to the press, eh? And then there is another gentleman of the cloth who is a Jesuit, and a very high professor indeed of that order. He teaches other Jesuits of high degree. All these people approve of my work. All these people write to me, giving their names and addresses quite safe in the knowledge that I never disclose names and addresses, except at the request of, or with the permission of, the person so quoted. Not everyone wants publicity. I don't, for one. But back to our bashful priest. He writes me a nice letter exclaiming in horror and amazement that people cannot believe my books. He tells me that the Catholic Church teach their adherents that at death the Christian, that is the Catholic Christian, leaves a physical body, and then God gives them a spirit one. I gather that after they all sing hallelujah together and play a few harps and flap about the astral countryside, well, okay, everyone to their own belief, but in substance this is only the same as what I have been writing about. Of course, people leave the physical body, and then they are not given a spirit body because they already have it. It's the astral body. Now it's really unfortunate that this respected reverend thinks that he's anonymous, because I would have liked to have written to him and told him that no, people do not disbelieve my books. I think that during the last 16 years that I have not had more than 4 or 5 really offensive letters, and letters expressing doubt, I have kept those in my, what shall I call it, black museum. But those are only the rantings of diseased minds. One person told me that God was going to strike me down dead. But if I would send her a sum of money, well, she would see that God wouldn't strike me down dead. Well, I didn't send any money, and I'm still here. Another lady wrote to me, highly incensed, because I wrote about backstreet healers and all that sort of thing. She told me of the wonders she had accomplished, how she cured cancer. And I believe, it's too much trouble to look it up, that she almost raised the dead. But now, she wrote to me full of fury, because people read my books and the cash customers had fallen off sharply. She accused me of ruining her income. Amusing, eh? I had another letter from a gentleman of color who wrote on behalf of himself and a friend. They said they would like to come and see me because they both wanted to become doctors. And so they wrote to me and asked if I would send them first-class airfares and provide them with an adequate sum of money so that they could look around a bit in the U.S. and decide where they'd like to live. The writer then went on to tell me that when they had decided where they would like to live, I could pay for the training of the two and all their living expenses for about 5 years. Longer, wrote one, if we should decide to specialize. Of course, they made it very clear that they would never be able to pay me back, but they gave me an absolute assurance that they would pray for me every day of my life. Naturally enough, I was touched to think of these gentlemen of color so heartily praying for me if I would give them thousands and thousands of dollars just for love of gentlemen of color, but I wasn't touched enough to part with a penny. Nowadays, I have to look at both sides of the penny, and I wish I was skilled in some of the arts known as splitting a note in two. Unfortunately, in Canada, as well as other countries of the world, the government do not like people to print their own money or make their own money. The government likes to keep a monopoly on that subject, although they look with great repugnance on other people who have a monopoly in anything. So there it is. The gentlemen of color go untrained, and I go with virgin purity, at least so far as counterfeiting is concerned. Now we've got to get on with some of these questions. You keep distracting me, you know? Of course, it is you who distracts me, because if you didn't keep on sending in these letters to me, I shouldn't be sidetracked by some of the curious comments you sometimes make. But anyway, back to these questions. A lady from India is most puzzled. She writes, "The call, which is a membrane which sometimes encloses a baby at birth, has it got any metaphysical or psychic significance to that individual?" No, it doesn't mean a thing. It doesn't mean any more than some people being born with black hair, some people being born with whatever you call it, blonde hair. the ginger stuff. A call is just something peculiar to that person, and it does not in any way increase one's psychic ability or spiritual power. Some people think otherwise, but it is really just an old wives' tale, as some people believe it is bad luck to have a black cat cross one's path at midnight on a moonless night. I don't know how they would see that black cat, though. Do you? Others think that it is a good fortune to have the aforementioned cat cross one's path under the aforementioned conditions. So there it is. I suggest you take the penny which I mentioned previously and decide which way you want to believe, and then toss up that penny to see if you're right or wrong. I state that a call doesn't mean a thing. Now, here's a question. Most causes which have influence upon us physically, that is, cancer, poverty, blindness, etc., have some form of fund to which one can contribute in order to help in all aspects of the problem in question. Is it possible to set up such a fund which could help causes such as yours? Oh, dear madam, that is a thing loaded with atom bomb material. The next thing we should find, if such a thing were done, is that the press would start up saying that I was exploiting the public or defrauding people or some similar rot. Some time ago it was suggested that I start up as a foundation. No, no, not the type of foundation worn by women, the benevolent kind. But I'm not at all keen on that because so many cults do have such a foundation, which enables them to set up some sort of stunt where they do not pay income tax on monies received, but which does enable them to pay very high salaries to themselves, to each other, for specialist services, whatever that means. I am honest, and regrettably honest enough to have an instinctive abhorrence of these foundations. So many of them are not what they purport to be. I always take the view that if a person is really anxious to help in the matter of research into the aura or into the other matters in which I am desperately interested, then they can always help with a donation if they want to, but that must be their own decision. Now, here is something which is going to rock you on your heels. The question is, wait a minute, let's get it straight. Okay. On the subject of Tai Chi in Wisdom of the Ancients, you said that the wise men of China used Tai Chi to indicate that to which we return upon leaving this world. It is the ultimate, or the end of all things, incarnate. It is reunion with one's over-self, and the state which upon earth can only be likened to bliss. Do you think you can expand on this? For example, has the Tai Chi got any light for us today, and what of its origin? But that is all that I've been telling you about in 13 books. When we leave this earth, we are a step nearer home. Each step up from plane to plane brings increases in joy, or what the questioner calls bliss. On each low stage of evolution, We have to work hard with relatively slight reward, but the higher we go, the greater our responsibilities, the less the physical work, and the higher the aspirations possible to us. So that, on this earth, for example, we can work with pick and shovel to the glory of God. There's nothing shameful in hard work. But you would not get the same remuneration as the president of the company employing you. You would get hard work and lower pay, but low responsibility, while the poor fellow sitting in his padded chair gets high pay, low physical work, and enough responsibility to give him ulcers. Well, the higher you go, the less physical work you do, but the greater enjoyment you derive from doing a job well done, the greater pleasure you get from being in the service of others. And the higher we go, well, when we get to the ninth plane of existence, for instance, we get in a state of bliss which would be quite incomprehensible in three-dimensional terms. It is like, dare I mention love, on earth through the onset of the Christian inhibitory practices, love is all mixed up with what is also known as sex. And here, sex is regarded as something unspeakable. It is regarded as dirty. So it is quite useless to try to explain to a person bogged down in imagined filth what love and sex are like on the ninth dimension. There are no terms to describe it. And yet, you have to have such a union of highly evolved souls before you can know what joy, bliss, rapture, happiness, and all the rest of it really mean. Has the Tai Chi got any light for us today? Well, we are in the age of Kali. We are in the descending stroke of the pendulum, and things are going to get a lot worse before they get a lot better. We're going down into the depths. When we reach the lowest point, then we shall start going up again until we reach what is, in effect, a state of rapture upon this earth. Of course, you and I won't be here then. We shall have passed to our just reward centuries before that time, but we can assure our place on the upward path if we at all times remember, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and then you'll be out of the age of Kali and on the way of Tai Chi. We're going up in the world once again. A countess sends me a bunch of questions. Do you want some questions from a countess? Well, all right, here's the first one. When a new world is created, the inhabitants for this world are also created to fit the living conditions. Are their souls also newly created, or are they already created and existing at that time? When a new world is created, the entities are already existing. Think of it like this. New York is overcrowded. There are far too many people there, so there could be a shortage of food, a shortage of electricity, a shortage of water, a shortage of everything, in fact. So, a fresh satellite town, city, or dormitory town is set up somewhere within reach. Let us say Westchester, for example. A load of people go to Westchester, and they set up stores and all the rest of it. In effect, that is a new world. So, when we get a new world created, it means that one of the old worlds is overcrowded or it is due for disintegration. You see, the sun, after all, is just an atomic pile, and though it might seem millions of years old to us, yet it is just the twinkling of an eye in certain other times. Do you find that difficult to understand? Take a match in your hand and think of that as in dead space. It's just a dead lump. Then strike it on the side of the matchbox and it will burst into flames. All sorts of small particles will be emitted and thrown out from the flaming surface. They, being much smaller, will cool very much more rapidly, and yet they will, so long as they are in close proximity to the match flame, be warmed. But that explosion of the match bursting into flame is only a second or two, isn't it? Perhaps it's not even that long. But just think of that sun giving birth to little planets, which are pieces thrown off. And those planets having the start of life, life itself. And then the decay of life as the flame of the central sun, the matchhead in this case, has a diminishing flame and then becomes a burnt-out husk. That is how worlds go on. To us, here on these particles, or rather on this one particle, it seems that the world exists for millions of years, but to people looking from afar, it's just like a matchhead bursting into sudden flame, flaring, and expiring. Question 2. If these new souls are newly created, how far does the multiplication go? How much room do we have? Where does it end? We're up against relativity here. Actually, space is limitless. We're not dealing with just a three-dimensional thing, but with things of all dimensions and things of no dimensions. On Earth, we're limited to certain dimensions. For example, I'm in a room. The room has four sides, and it has a roof. It has a floor. When I'm in this room and the door is shut, I cannot go out without opening that door. But if a person of the fourth dimension, who we would call a ghost, wanted to come in, well, there'd be no problem, because the molecules of the wall here would be so tenuous to a ghost that he would simply drift through without any problems at all. It is something like ice, which is a hard, solid substance. People living on a world of ice would have no conception of what their souls would be like. But let us kill some ice. Let us alter its rate of vibration. Because when a thing dies, its rate of vibration alters. This ice, then, that we're going to kill, turns into water. It's a completely different sort of substance from ice. The water flows. It can take up the shape of the receptacle which retains it. But we want to find the soul of ice. So let us heat up the water and thereby increase its vibration. And then we get steam, a gas. So if you think of a body, a human body, as being represented by ice, then you can readily appreciate that the next stage up, when the ice turns to water, is when we get out of the body and get into the astral world and we flow about. Beyond that, well, we go from the water stage up into the water vapor stage, up into the gas stage. So, you could not push a piece of ice through an apparently solid substance, such as a piece of blotting paper, but you could push water through. Even better, you could blow steam all the way through easily. You can see, though, that the molecules of ice, the molecules of water, and the molecules of steam are different. They get more and more dispersed as one goes up. We get the same thing with the body and the soul of man. Question 3. We were taught that our Maker is a one God. Is really just one entity at the head of all creation? Or is it a governing group at the head of our all? You really do ask the stickiest of questions in this one about God. You ask, is it really one entity at the head of all creation? Well, look at it like this. You are a human, and presumably you have a head, feet, arms, and a few other bits stuck on your body at strategic points. All of this makes you, just one of you. And your hands, your feet, your knees, your everything goes to form that one. And all those parts are dependent upon each other. Of course, you could do without a hand or without a leg, but you couldn't do without a head, although most people seem to try to nowadays. But God is that entity which comprises the whole of the universes, and there are billions of them, and each universe and part of a universe is an essential part of the basic God. Question 4. Will our souls live forever after we will graduate from this world? After so many lives, we will go to better places? You have convinced me of that fact. How many worlds will we graduate to, and where will we end? Yes, our souls will live as long as God lives, because our souls, our overselves, etc., are just part of the fabric of God. If you stick a pin in yourself and withdraw it from your quivering body, it may appear that the pin is quite clean, bare of anything. But if you stick it in the field of a very powerful microscope, you may find one lonely molecule waving at you through the electronic magnifier. Well, that one lonely molecule can be just as you are to God. Question 5. I was brought up a Catholic and went to school in a convent. We were taught very little about the years Jesus had disappeared. Was he really in Asia learning during that time? So many books say so many different things about this. If he spent all these years in Asia, he must have liked what he learned. Of course, my entire conception of him has changed since I became really more religious, which has nothing to do with the particular religion. You will hear from me again soon. Now, I wonder if that last statement, you will hear from me again soon, was a threat or a promise? I must think about it. But anyway, yes, Jesus the man wandered abroad in the wilderness being that part of the world which was not his immediate and familiar vicinity or the vicinity of his birth. Jesus went throughout India, throughout China, into Tibet, and much of the original Christian religion is actually a conglomeration of Eastern religions which have been hashed up, worked over, and tailored to fit what is, in effect, a Western mentality. Most certainly, Jesus liked what he found in the East, because after, according to the press report which I've already given you, he went to Japan instead of being crucified. After Jesus, the man, came back from his travels, he went again into a distant place where he would not be bothered by onlookers, and there he left his physical body and went on to other places. His body was taken over by another entity from space, as had previously been arranged. So Jesus the man departed his body, and the spirit of Christ took over and became the Christ. That, then, is transmigration and nothing else. So many people seem to find difficulty in comprehending this matter of transmigration, but Christ taught it. Christ taught reincarnation also, and if people would read the Bible with an open mind, they would understand all these things. They should also take into consideration the definite fact that the Bible now is not as it was originally, nor how it was intended to be. The Bible has been translated, retranslated, mistranslated, rehashed, and thousands of different editions brought out. Sometimes the head of a church will say that such a thing cannot be taught anymore. Then he will scratch his own head and bring out something else which should be taught. The Bible should be looked upon as a general statement of policy rather than a blow-by-blow, round-by-round account of what happened. It is quite a good book, but you have to use common sense in reading a book which is so old and which is so different in concept to that which was originally planned. End of chapter 8.